The Omnivore's Dilemma, reading assignment number 6, chapter 12. Polyface Farms, Green Acres. Early in the afternoon on the first day of summer, I found myself sitting in the middle of a bright green pasture. The first day of summer is the longest day of the year. This day felt like the longest day of my life. I was more tired than I thought anyone could be. I'd spent the afternoon making hay. After just a few hours in the June sun, lifting and throwing 50-pound bales, I hurt. We think of grass as soft and friendly stuff, but once it's been dried in the sun and shredded by machines, it becomes hay. And the ends of hay are like needles, sharp enough to draw blood. My forearms were dotted red with pinpricks, and my lungs were filled with hay dust. Joel Salatin had gone off to the barn with his grown son, Daniel. That left me a welcome moment in the pasture to rest before we started up again. It was Monday, the first day of the week I would spend on the farm. After just a half a day, I knew I would never again complain about any price a farmer wanted to charge me for food. If the work was this hard, $1 for an egg seemed reasonable. $50 for a steak was a steal. Time travel? The farm machinery had fallen silent, and I could hear the sounds of songbirds in the trees, and also the low clucking of hens. Up on the green, green hill, rising to the west, I could see a small herd of cattle grazing. The meadows were dotted with the contented animals. Behind them was the backdrop of dark woods. A twisting brook threaded through it all. It was almost too perfect farm scene. The only problem was that I couldn't just lie there on the springy pasture for the rest of the afternoon. I thought about how amazing it was that the farm existed at all. This was exactly the way farms had been before industrial food and feedlots and giant wet mills. Yet I had not traveled back in time. This farm was living and thriving today just as 150 miles from Washington, D.C. I'd come to Polyface Farm to find out if it was possible for a non-industrial food chain to survive in the 21st century. Was this farm just a lone holdout against industrial food? Or did it represent a new wave of logical organic farms that could survive outside the industrial food chain? In short, I wanted to know if this kind of farming was the past or the future. Looking at those green pastures that afternoon, I thought the only thing missing from the scene was a happy shepherd. But then I saw a tall fellow loping towards me, wearing broad blue suspenders and a floppy straw hat. It was Joel Salatin, owner of Polyface, returning from the barn. Most farmers wear a trucker's cap marked with the logo of an agribusiness giant. Salatin's hat had no logo, and it was made of grass, not plastic. This was fitting because grass, not petroleum, is the foundation of his farm's success. The Grass Farmer. Polyface Farm raises chickens, beef, turkeys, eggs, rabbits, and pigs, plus tomatoes, sweet corn, grapes, and berries. They do all this on 100 acres of pasture mixed in with another 450 acres of forest. But if you ask Joel Salatin what he does for a living, you'll say, "I'm a grass farmer." First time I heard this, I didn't get it all. People can't eat grass, and he doesn't sell any of his hay to other farmers. How could he be in the grass business? But of course, Salatin was right. As I was to learn during my stay, the cows, pigs, chickens, turkeys, and rabbits at Polyface, as well as Salatin and his family, all depend on grass in one way or another. Grass, of course, is not a single plant. It is our name for the whole collection of plants that grow together in pasture or meadow. Polyface Farm is the opposite of an industrial farm like George Naylor's or Earthbound. Those industrial farms grow giant monoculture fields. Their farms run like factories. They put in the seed and the fertilizer, raw materials, and out comes corn or soybeans, product. It's a pretty straight line from start to finish. Nothing at Polyface works in the straight line. The animals and crops seem to move in circles like some sort of complicated dance. Each plant and animal plays its part, and Joel Salatin is the choreographer. The pastures are the stage, and the main action of the dance is to rotate the animals through the pastures. Pastures of plenty. The pasture I was resting in was a good example. It was the third week of June, and the field had already been occupied several times. It had been grazed twice by beef cattle. After the cattle, it had been home to several hundred laying hens. Later, the grass had been cut to make hay that would feed the farm's animals through the winter. I asked Salatin why the chickens had been let loose in the pasture instead of fed in a chicken coop. "Because that's how it works in nature," he explained. "Birds follow up and clean up after herbivores." Joel calls the hens his sanitation crew. In the pasture, they pick tasty grubs and fly larvae out of the cow pats. Larvae are one stage in the life cycle of insects. For example, caterpillars are butterfly larvae. Eating the grubs and the larvae cuts down on bugs and parasites. In this case, tiny organisms that live in or on the cow that would bother the cattle. And while the chickens are nibbling on the grasses, they add a few thousand pounds of nitrogen to the pasture with their own droppings. And the produce several thousand rich and tasty eggs. After a few weeks' rest, the pasture will regrow and feed the cows again. By the end of the season, Salatin's animals will have transformed his grasses into an astounding amount of food. Yet even more amazing is the fact that this pasture will be in better, not worse shape. Its soil will be deeper, more fertile, and even springier underfoot. This thanks to the increased earthworm traffic. And the whole process is powered by the sun. No fossil fuels, or added fertilizer, or chemicals needed. Grass and humans. BFF? When we look at beef ranching, we learned how grasses and herbivores formed a partnership over millions of years of evolution. In the same way, human beings and grasses also have been partners. People in prehistoric times often hunted the big herbivores that dined on grass. Those hunters would regularly set fire to the prairie to keep it free of trees and nourish the soil. In a sense, they too were grass farmers. They helped the grass, and the grass in turn fed the animals they hunted. The bonds between humans and grass grew even stronger about 10,000 years ago. About that time, people learned to plant and grow grasses like wheat, rice, and corn. These grasses were different because they produced big, rich seeds. Humans could harvest and eat those seeds. They didn't need herbivores to turn the grass into meat. Grains like wheat and corn are grasses, but they're different from the grasses in Joel Salatin's meadow. Meadow grasses can reproduce even if they are eaten or mowed before they can make seeds. They do this by sending out shoots or runners that become new plants. They also have deep root systems that help them to recover quickly from grazing or prairie fire. These roots survive through the winter and then start growing new leaves in the spring. Plants that do this are called perennials because they come back year after year. Wheat, rice, and corn are annuals. That means they don't put down a deep root system. Instead, they survive by making seeds, which have to be planted every year. Because these seeds are edible, human beings took these annuals and helped them spread across the globe. We cut down forests and plowed up the prairies to make room for the giant seed-bearing grasses. They are the backbone of our agriculture and our food supply. Industrial versus organic. So if you think of corn as a big annual grass, then George Naylor in Iowa is also a grass farmer. But Naylor's farm is one link in a chain that includes fossil fuels, artificial fertilizer, pesticides, heavy machinery, feedlots, antibiotics, and processing plants. The oil comes mostly from the Middle East. The corn comes from Iowa. The beef is slaughtered in Kansas, and then the meat has to be shipped by truck across the country to a Walmart or McDonald's near you. You can think of the industrial food system as a great machine. It's a machine that stretches over thousands of miles. It runs on fossil fuel and creates tons of waste and pollution. Polyface Farm stands about as far from industrial agribusiness as you can get. Almost everything in the farm uses is grown on the farm. Almost all of the energy used to make the food comes from the sun. There are no pesticides, no artificial fertilizer, no pollution, no extra waste. Everything is recycled. Just compare the two farms. Naylor Farm, industrial, annual species, monoculture, fossil fuels, global market, imported fertility. Polyface Farms, ecological, perennial species, diverse crop species, solar energy, local market, local fertility. Organic versus beyond organic. As I discovered in that first phone call, Polyface is so outside the industrial food chain that Salatin won't even sell his beef, chicken, or pork by mail. You can't order it on a website. We never called ourselves organic, he went on to explain. We called ourselves beyond organic. He talked about the difference between one of his chickens and an organic chicken you can buy in a supermarket. The supermarket chicken it raised in a 10,000-bird shed that stinks to high heaven. His chickens do not eat non-organic grain, but they see a new paddock of fresh green grass every day. Then he asks, so which chicken shall we call organic? That is the end of chapter 12. Your next reading assignment will take place in chapter 14.